Good afternoon and welcome to the Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH, streaming live on all those smart speakers like Amazon Echo and Google Home. A council member is calling on the prosecuting attorney's office to prosecute fewer criminals. But he's pretending he's doing it to address a staffing crisis. What's the truth? Well, that is what's trending.
What's trending? Equity.
King County Councilmember Girmay Zahalai complains that putting criminals in jails is simply unrealistic because our criminal legal systems are at a quote-unquote breaking point. Huh. He definitely hopes you don't realize he's one of the local radicals who pushed to starve the criminal justice system of resources, putting it in a position to be at a so-called breaking point. This is all by design. He just hopes you don't connect the dots. The reason why I wrote my book, What's Killing America, is because of people like this, who make excuses, who make claims, while hoping no one in local media connect dots. So let's connect some dots. He put out an editorial co-written by Anita Condelwall. She's the director of the King County Department of Public Defense, so public defenders, basically. And they wanted to call out proponents of a tough-on-crime approach to the crisis. I am one of the people who endorses, reasonably so, a tough-on-crime posture. Because Seattle, we're talking about King County, but Seattle specifically is on pace to exceed an all-time high number of homicides. We have fatal drug overdoses setting another record. We have criminals taking advantage of reforms, allowing them to drive cars into storefronts before robbing them of whatever it is that they can grab. Reasonable people want to see criminals punished. But the radical left, they view criminals as victims of an unjust society. And after George Floyd was killed, activists promised to dismantle the criminal justice system. They viewed it as a system of oppression. And particularly in King County, that's precisely what they did. But now Zahalai is feigning concern that, quote, our region's criminal legal systems are not only at capacity, they are flirting with their breaking points. And in this editorial, he lists a whole bunch of things about a lack of resources within the King County criminal legal system. He writes, the King County Sheriff's Office cannot find enough new deputies to fill its ranks. Historic backlogs in our court system delay cases for years. And the King County Jail has had intractable staffing shortages. Corrections officers themselves have pleaded for more diversion programs, stating their inability to keep themselves and incarcerated people safe at current staffing levels. That's so interesting. And it's kind of curious why he would complain about that, because he did what he could to chase the deputies from their jobs. He voted to defund the King County Sheriff's Office. He moved millions of dollars that were earmarked for the Sheriff's Office into diversion programs. He doesn't seem to ever miss an opportunity to villainize cops. He helped activists set the stage for CHOP. He was the guy who declared a rally, quote unquote, peaceful while a dude was shouting threats against police officers. The sheriff's office has a staffing crisis because few people want to work for rabidly anti-police lawmakers like Girmay Zahalai. And yet he blames this and some other staff openings on a, quote unquote, national labor crisis. Right. He says there's a backlog of cases. Yeah, that's true. Because he and other radicals favored criminal justice reforms that kept criminals out of jail, which meant they continued to reoffend, which meant they inspired a culture of lawlessness that has since spiraled out of control. Crime begets more crime. And when they do get caught, they get forwarded on to the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, only for those prosecutors, for those public defenders to work with the prosecutors to say, hey, let's not go with jail for this guy. I'm sure it's his 70th time being arrested and charged. Let's put him in a diversion program. That the restorative justice will work in this case. I promise. This time will be the time. So they're wasting time there. It doesn't end up working, only to see that same person go back in front of the court, having a public defender working on them, again in concert with the prosecutor, to say, let's give him another shot. 71 is the charm. 71 does it. That'll do the trick. They keep people out of jail, then they complain that they have to do their jobs when they get arrested again for committing yet another crime. That's ludicrous. Keep in mind, public defenders, in this case, we're talking about severe radicals. They were, 2 years ago, they were the ones trying to keep suspects accused of sex crimes, trying to keep prolific car thieves out of jail. And at the time, it would appear that Zahalai was a supporter of that. He also voted against a contract to transfer inmates from the overcrowded downtown King County Jail to the facility, it's called SCORE, in Des Moines, the South Correctional Entity. He opposed that despite the fact that if he voted in favor of it, and by the way, it ended up getting voted in favor, just not by him and one other council member, that was meant to lessen the load that the staff have to take on as corrections officers. We're putting people in another jail because it's easier for the staff at the King County Corrections Facility. And yet he has the audacity here to complain about that. So, man, it's really tough. We're at a breaking point. You created the breaking point. Not you alone, but you helped create this breaking point. And then you continue to read this editorial he wrote in the Times, and it becomes incredibly clear. All this is about, is getting to a point where we charge fewer criminals. He writes, public defenders are the latest justice system employees to test their breaking points. Newly published research spotlights the unsustainable caseloads King County public defenders have been working to manage. These caseloads grow even worse daily as experienced defenders qualified to handle the most serious cases quit, leaving a smaller and smaller number of attorneys to handle those most serious cases. Then he goes on to say that the county should only charge, quote, on the gravest allegations of illegal behavior. This dude is arguing against charging criminals. This isn't about a lack of resources. He wants you to think it is because it comes off as if he's showing some sort of compassion to our hardworking public defenders. No. He doesn't want them to do their jobs because he doesn't want to put people in jail. He is an abolitionist. He takes on that attitude. He's taken on that attitude for a very long time. That was what makes him a radical. This editorial is co-written by an extremist public defender who's effectively complaining that they have to do their jobs to argue why someone shouldn't go to jail. They just want to go to the point where they just say, we're just not even going to charge them. Let's not waste our time by going into the jail. We keep giving a pass to criminals in this state, and it's oftentimes the most privileged lawmakers and activists who advocate on behalf of criminals, not on the victims. Zahalai is arguing that we shouldn't jail some teenager who steals a Butterfinger from a 7-Eleven, right? He's arguing that. Focus on the serious thing. We don't jail that kid right now. We don't put that kid in jail right now. So it's a phony argument. But he's also arguing that that lowlife who drives a car into a business's storefront, steals whatever it is he can steal, and then drives off in another stolen vehicle, that person should escape prosecution. He shouldn't see any jail time. What if it's his seventh time doing it? Restorative justice. I reject that. You reject that. Most people reject this. And then, of course, he dismisses drug offenses and property crimes as quote unquote low level, that they're undeserving of charges. First of all, we almost never charge for drug offenses in King County. The only time you see those charges is when they are coupled with another crime like an assault or an armed robbery that is committed in order to feed that person's drug habit. Second of all, felonious property crime is very serious. It doesn't just impact, by the way, the victim whose property ended up getting destroyed. It impacts the neighborhood because then people feel less safe in their own community. And by the way, those criminals almost always graduate to way more serious offenses, including violent crime, that hurts people, kills people. We have already undercharged and released dangerous criminals from the consequences that they otherwise would have faced in record numbers. Does anyone actually think that's worked? Has crime gotten better or worse since we've adopted the light on crime approach? Since we've decided at the county level and the state level to prosecute fewer criminals? Has crime gotten worse? Yes. But if you listen to him, Zahalai, this council member from King County, you think we'd have no choice but to release even more criminals from jail. He doesn't think much of the people reading his editorial or the people who maybe saw his tweet the other day calling me out. Because when he originally printed this editorial, I sent out my own tweet basically accusing him of everything I just outlined. And his response was that I'm just not being honest. I'm the one gaslighting. That I don't have any evidence to suggest that King County has attempted to starve its criminal justice system of resources. I guess forgetting that I have access to a thing called the internet, where I can type in his name and then defund and see all the things that he's done. See, I came with receipts. But he gaslights even more because in this piece he says, there exists a pervasive narrative that the public safety crisis could be solved if local governments just prosecuted and jailed more people for property and drug offenses. If we were tougher on crime, some say, these problems would go away. The individuals who push such ideas, however, have never uttered a sensible plan for how to increase prosecution and incarceration in our current reality. What in God's name are you talking about? What are you talking about? We've never offered a sensible plan. Okay, how about this? And the truth is, he says sensible plan because he doesn't think any plan is sensible when it means putting criminals in jail. That's how he gets out of it. He's lying there. He's not being misleading. He's just flat out lying to you. Him not believing in jail time for criminals doesn't mean that there's no plan. A quick way to lessen the caseload for public defenders is to prosecute and jail prolific offenders who have zero interest in reforming their lives because of enablers like Zahalai. They come in and out of the system all the time because they're never punished. And when you're tough on dangerous criminals who pose threats, who lessen our quality of life, guess what happens? We all benefit. They're in jail. You're not having to defend them 12 different times. When you let police actually police, paying them what they're worth, not demonizing every chance you get, you will naturally attract more people into the profession. That's how this works. You can complain about staffing all you want, council member. But the fact of the matter is, you don't want more cops, so stop pretending otherwise. You like the current staffing level because you view police as the enemy. And the fewer officers we have, be them deputies or police officers for local agencies, the fewer we have, the more criminals get away with their crimes, which should make you happy because it seems those are the only people you seem to care about. Now, while you do that, while you support police officers with my sensible plan that you don't think is sensible, you know what we can also do? We can fund organizations that promote family. We're not supposed to talk about that. It's deemed racist by the radical left. But the fact of the matter is, especially when we're talking about young boys, when they come from broken families, they are more likely to go down the wrong path, taken advantage of by adults who push them down that wrong path. But that's been declared, that conversation is racist. You can't talk about it anymore. Now, none of what I said is especially innovative. It's just going back to the way things were before the radical left declared everything an example of white supremacy culture. They dismantled our systems and everything got worse. Did we have this crime crisis in 2019? No. 2018? No. 2017? No. Did we have it in 2020 and 2021 and 2022 and 2023 coincided directly with the criminal justice reforms? Yes. 100%. But he doesn't want to acknowledge that. I don't know why. As I've been doing interviews for the book, people have asked me, well, why do they believe this particular thing? How do they not see what's going on? And I give two answers to that because I think they fall into one of two groups. Number one, they're such believers of this cult of progressivism and radical leftism. They legitimately have blinders on and they don't see the crisis. they're in denial. Or they're such true believers that they understand that there's going to be short-term pain for long-term gain. So you can justify the situation right now because in their view, if you commit to this long enough, well, things will get better. And then we'll be in this utopian society in which the criminal justice system is not inherently racist. Now, their observations as to or what they think would be the end goal of their plot, I find foolish and dangerous. And the data backs me up. It doesn't back him up. And yet, he's trying to pull a fast one on everybody by printing this editorial, which I'm sure some people say, wow, he really does care. He's, you know, he's acknowledging a reality. We just don't have enough public defenders. Hire more. Oh, well, there's a national crisis. Oh, really? Really? All public? I thought that they were all moved to this profession. Oh, but they're just so burnt out by having to put criminals in jail, see their clients go to jail. Well, then be a better public defender. Be a better lawyer, and they won't go to jail. Oh, but you're just sort of rejecting the idea that criminals would go to jail in the first place. Got it. Now, I wrote about this online at ktth.com. I hope you'll go there. This will be one of the topics, by the way, at the Freedom Series. We have tickets on sale right now for $7.70. We are a little over half sold out. I'm still looking at the seat chart, and my favorite seat, the one that I would want to sit in, has not been taken. The seats around it have been taken, but the one that I would choose has not yet been taken. $7.70. Today is the last day to also order a book with your ticket, an autographed book. It's guaranteed to be autographed, so you don't have to buy the book and then show up with the book to get it signed, hopefully. You can get it when you check in with your ticket. That's available for an extra fee. It's at ktth.com. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Crime.
A comic book shop called Tales to Astonish, which is a horrible name for a shop. It's based out of West Seattle. They just suffered its second break-in. Second break-in within 6 weeks. They broke in on Saturday morning. It was about 10:30. And they ended up stealing tens of thousands of dollars worth of comics, or just thousands. I added the 10 to be a little bit more dramatic, but comics are kind of lame.
I'm not going to lie to you. It's going to be really tough to keep the doors open.
Now, that's the owner. Speaking with Caro 7 TV, his name is Sean. He says some of the comics that were stolen were very high in value, including one I think was either signed by Stan Lee or it had a personal
couple signed by Stan Lee, I think.
Like that for nerds goes a long way. Nerds are willing to spend a lot because they're not spending their money on going out on dates. And so they're spending their money on comics. Now, the first time this happened 6 weeks ago, thieves came in from the back door. Now they broke in through the front. They decided, we already did it from behind. Now we're going to break the storefront down, We're going to go in the third time we'll come in from the roof. The fourth time they'll drill a hole underneath.
It seems like they've got it out for us. I don't know what else to say.
And I imagine that you would come to the same conclusion if what would appear to be the same people just based on the surveillance video hit you again. They either are targeting you because they don't like you, or they're targeting you because they don't think that you can defend your store, that your security is not where it needs to be. But now he's beefed up his security. He's no longer going to have comics worth more than $100 on his shelves. That's going to be kept somewhere off-site and maybe only sold online, or you'll have to be inconvenienced and order it and then pick it up in the shop, which is not fair to him.
We still have new comic books every Wednesday, and people are still going to come in here and buy their new books, and hopefully we can at least make it until insurance possibly gives us some money.
Now, is that fair to him to be put in this position? Maybe to the council member Zahalai, it's totally okay. Why are you complaining? You have insurance. Well, this is a guy who's saying he might not be able to survive as a business owner, only to then be told by the council member that the people who broke into his shop should not be prosecuted and put in jail. We'll put them in restorative justice, which is an unaccountable group of programs in King County. Very little oversight. A whole lot of abuses of the system. So how does he stay afloat?
Half of our business that we did was back issue sales. And 3/4 of our back issue value was probably on these walls.
You can hear it in his voice, right? Just demoralized, as any of us would be if we were in his position. It's not fair. It's not fair, but no one's going to fight for him. When was the last time you heard a city leader, with one exception of Sarah Nelson on the Seattle City Council, but looking in King County, when was the last time someone stepped up and said, you know what, I'm going to fight for the small business owners, not for the criminals. I'm going to fight to get these people justice instead of saying, I'm going to fight to keep you out of jail. We want less prosecutions. You know what? You're a victim, actually. You're a victim of a racist criminal justice system. And we're going to do something for you. We're going to get you on that right path. You need our support. What about this guy? What about Sean Duff? Feels like he needs support too. But he's not going to get it, not with the current radicals who are in positions of power. So maybe it's time for all of us to step up, take this a little bit more seriously, and put better people into office. 1-800-465-8770 for your text messages. 1-800-465-8770. We come back, we're going to talk with a local activist who is trying to get gender extremism out of Seattle public schools. How is she going to do it? How can you help? We'll get into it when we come back on the Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing us these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
Obviously, anyone who's paying attention to what's going on in our schools, you are well aware of the indoctrination, especially as it relates to gender identity and gender extremism. My next guest is one of many who is pushing back, telling Seattle Public Schools, no, we're not doing this anymore. Joining me on the line is a local activist, Carol Dansereau. Carol, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
So take me through what you're engaged in right now, because you're doing some activism, you're calling on the school board to take some action. Just give us the 30,000-foot view of the movement.
Well, on September 27th, people from across the political spectrum delivered a demand for action to the Seattle School Board to end the promotion of gender identity ideology in our schools. So we felt it was important to have a formal, official demand delivered to them that spells out why we're concerned, provides documentation, and tells them in no uncertain terms that this is an outrage that will not be tolerated.
What are some examples of what's been going on in public schools that you object to?
The public schools are aggressively promoting gender identity ideology. They are giving kids blatantly false information about biology, such as telling them that men can have babies. They are forcing kids to not just memorize the mantras of gender ideology, but to belong to that faith. To engage in compelled speech, referring to males as females, forfeiting their rights to sex-based privacy, forfeiting female-only sports. This is happening through books that are read in the elementary schools and the lesson plans that go with those. In the sex ed curriculum, there's not only the gender identity unit, which forces kids to memorize the mantras of this faith, the gender identity faith, but also the sexual anatomy, pregnancy, reproduction units all really push gender identity by basically removing words like man and woman.
Yep.
So kids see diagrams of male anatomy, and they believe that this could be a female if the person with that body thinks of themselves as a woman. So there's all that stuff in the curriculum and much more I could get into. And then there's the flags and the posters and the extra mailings sent to people and days of remembrance and all sorts of things pushing this agenda. But perhaps most importantly is School Policy 3211, which mandates affirmation only, which basically means that teachers must automatically agree when a child declares that they're a different sex or no sex or multiple sexes. They have to automatically say, why, yes, you are. And then all the kids in the school, everyone in the school, has to go along with that, forfeiting their rights.
While keeping it a secret from parents at the exact same time. That,
right. And not only that, but the teachers are required to make sure that they don't let parents know if parents might have some concerns about the fact that their child is saying they're a different sex at school and being funneled along on this conveyor belt towards a pediatric sex change. Because that, of course, is one of our major concerns, is the schools are teaching children to dissociate from their bodies, mm-hmm. to believe that there's this gendered soul that's separate from your body. And if you're really authentic, you'll go with what the soul says you are and you'll reject your body. And the pediatric sex change medicalization that's going on is just truly horrific.
It really is. And they're hiding the truth. You and I, before going on air, we spoke a little bit about it. The University of Washington, I did a story last year at some point, or maybe it was a year and a half ago, basically outlining how they were just being dishonest about some of the data that was collected during a study on transgender healthcare, where they could maybe argue at best that it didn't have an impact in either direction, which is generally what you'll find in all these studies, that when you look at gender-affirming healthcare, so-called gender-affirming care, as relates to youth, at best you'll see no change in their mental health. At worst, they become suicidal or more suicidal. So this idea that there's just a mountain of evidence showing that this is the right way to go, that these are the right procedures to take, that's just not true.
Right. And in fact, there have now been multiple systematic reviews of the evidence. That means they look at all the studies and they weigh the strength of each study. And each one of these has concluded that the benefits are not established because the quality of the evidence is so awful. And as you said, there's actually strong indications that suicidality and reduced mental health can occur after people have been medically altered. So the evidence isn't there for the so-called benefits, but the harms are crystal clear.
Yeah.
They're huge. They're irreversible. I mean, blocking a child's maturation, blocking puberty, that doesn't just affect their sexual organs. It affects their brains and their bones and wrong sex hormones and girls getting their breasts cut off. And yes, some kids are having genital surgeries. All of that has just massive adverse implications for children.
Carol Danzerow,
most of which are irreversible.
Yeah, Carol Danzerow joining me on the line. She's calling on the Seattle School Board to reject the gender identity extremism in the classroom. What was it like the first time you decided to stand up and say something? You know, lots of times, especially in Seattle or any really blue city, it's intimidating to get up in front of folks that you presume completely disagree with you and have consumed the Kool-Aid.
Right. Well, I've had a number of experiences now that are extremely unpleasant. I have been at events where a small band of us attempted to speak in a public space and mobs of frenzied young people pushed into us, screaming in our faces and forced made it impossible for people to hear us, and actually led to our events being canceled and us being forced out of public spaces. That has happened to me multiple times. I know people who have been fired from their jobs because of their own time, activism, and so much more. This is a really authoritarian, it is a cult. It is an authoritarian cult. And actually, when we spoke to the school board on the 27th, we experienced something pretty horrific there as well. During the day, we knew from monitoring some Facebook discussions that the so-called trans rights activists wished that they could figure out a way so that we people who had signed up to give public testimony, who have concerns about gender ideology, could be prevented from speaking. But they couldn't figure out that. They mentioned that they maybe should try to talk to the boss of one of the people, but they couldn't do that because she's a partner in a law firm. Maybe they could do bad reviews. So anyway, they were forced to accept that we were going to be allowed to each have 2 minutes. Five people were going to be allowed to have 2 minutes. So they showed up en masse to stand up against this horrible, horrible menace. And the school board was just awful. Before the public comment period happened, there was a full half hour of school board members giving speeches designed to tell everybody that we were hateful, horrible people who didn't believe that children exist. We want to see kids erased. I mean, it was horrific. It was a half hour of speeches to demonize us and to make it crystal clear that the board has no interest in being fully informed on these extremely important matters.
Well, let me ask you this then. It was obviously tough, and it was, let's just call it an experience. Why should anyone listening right now then join? I mean, I imagine no one wants to have to experience that. So what's your pitch to parents or anybody else who just is seeing what's going on, wants to say something, but also doesn't want to encounter what you encountered?
Well, the most important thing that we are doing is finding each other. And I tell you, my inbox is just jammed full of people contacting me today. But there's all sorts of other work going on to do that. And the thing is, we can't be silent because this is so important. What's happening to the kids, the implications for democracy in general with this kind of attitude and allowing this kind of suppression to happen are just unacceptable. But what's happening is that truly, overwhelmingly, when people understand what's going on, they reject gender identity ideology strongly. And so the thing we need to do is find each other, because when we stand up together, the bullies have no power. So we saw in Canada, I think it was the 20th of September, across that country, there were thousands upon thousands of people who came out to the streets to say, we do not agree with this gender ideology in our schools. And there were so many of them standing up together that the bullies had no power. So there's all sorts of signs that the facade is cracking, this facade of, oh, we're all about love and civil rights, when they're exactly about the opposite. That's cracking. And there are tons of us across the political spectrum. I personally am a left-wing person.
Yep.
Who are working together. And we are getting very close to critical mass. And, you know, it was an experience, but we're fine. We stood up and we spoke, and we will do it again, and more people will be doing this.
Well, and to your point, it feels a little bit uncomfortable, but you will survive. It's tough. Again, I understand why people don't want to have to get that kind of scrutiny from a bunch of bullies. But to Carol's point, if you guys all do it at once, guess what? They don't have any power. You have all the power. And instead of being the silent majority ceding so much power to these radicals on the left, it's time to step up. We're connecting the dots on our own, and it needs to be exposed. Carol, how do people get a hold of you?
Well, the best thing to do is look up my Substack, which is caroldansereau.substack.com. If you go to the About page, you can see an email to use to reach me, and you can also read the Substack articles, including the one about the September 27th board meeting and a follow-up that will share the details of the speeches that were made and what we're doing next.
There you go, caroldansereau.substack.com. It's spelled D-A-N-S-E-R-E-A-U. Thank you so much for stopping by, and best of luck as you take on this fight.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. When we come back, we'll dive into some quick hits.
The Jason Rand Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rand. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rand is in focus now.
Jason Rand, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
Yesterday, students had to pay back their student loans after being put on pause, without any interest, by the way, since COVID-19. And they're claiming to be disheartened and concerned. It's scary that they're going to have to pay back what they promised to pay back. Now, I'm sorry, I don't have sympathy here. not this far into it. I'd have sympathy and did have sympathy for folks whose jobs were lost as a direct result of decisions politicians made around COVID shutting down industries. And I certainly don't think they should have been charged any interest during that time period, nor have to pay in that moment because they lost a job through no fault of their own. But we've got a bunch of people who are very clearly taking advantage of the situation and pretending that they're in a tough spot when they're the ones who put themselves in the so-called tough spot. Because King 5 went out and spoke to some UW students to explain, well, how much do you guys owe?
$40,500. $22,000.
It's only about like $3,000.
Now, interesting, I'm not sure how a UW student ends up getting $40,000 into student loan debt. That's an outlier for a state school, unless I guess she could be coming from out of state, but that's on her. $3,000 is also an outlier. That's relatively low unless it was higher and he was doing the right thing and paying it back. But the fact of the matter is, people took on a loan voluntarily. No one twisted their arms. They chose to take on a loan to go to a school of their choice, most likely a school they didn't have to attend, by the way. And now they come out of school, they get their degree in women's study or philosophy, something that's clearly not going to lead to them making a lot of money post-college. And then they complain that they have to pay things back after, by the way, getting a pass well past when COVID was a thing. This went into effect yesterday, October 1st. Okay? 2023, not 2021, not even 2022, but 2023. You've had more than enough time to figure this out. And they either chose not to, not because they couldn't, but because they didn't want to, because they didn't need to, because the Democrats kept giving them a pass. So they either are in this position because they chose not to, or they should not have gotten the loan to begin with, and now they're asking for a bailout without any sort of information coming from them about, well, what did you study? Why did you go into debt to this degree? What's going on exactly? And so for King 5 to amplify these concerns and make it seem like we're supposed to really feel bad for folks who put themselves in a position, I resent. There is no doubt some people suffering through no fault of their own. And if you were to come up with some sort of policy that was tailor-made for them, we can have that discussion. I'd be more apt to accepting something like that. But I'm not going to pretend that the majority of these kids are in a tough spot because of something that the government did. That's just not true.
It's stressful to be getting the emails that are like, hey, it's time to start repayment.
Why is it stressful when you've had all this time to save up money? We're talking about small loan repayments for the most part every single month. And you had a ton of time to work. I thought Bidenomics meant that people were working and could afford these kinds of things. In fact, isn't the young kids, Henry or Harry Sisson, on Twitter telling me, Bidenomics? Why isn't Bidenomics helping you? What's going on? Now, Ann Flanagan is the vice president of public relations with Washington State Employees Credit Union. She's warning people to King 5, you better start paying.
Down the line, you may be needing an auto loan. You may be ready to apply for that mortgage. And this can really impact your credit rating.
If they don't pay or if they're late. And if you think this is stressful, wait till you get that mortgage payment that's due. Or will you learn and not actually take out a loan for a home that you can't afford? Look, for some people, and I've talked about this a number of times, I don't necessarily blame a 17, 18-year-old kid who makes a poor decision to go to a college they can't afford. I put more blame on the parent or parents who didn't say anything, who didn't say, hey, you know, Johnny, I know you're really passionate about photography, but I'm not sending you to school to learn photography. You can go take a course. I'm not going to spend, you know, $110,000 on an education when you're going to get a degree in photography because you're not going to make that money back. We can't afford it. And if you're hell-bent on going to school for photography, great. Let's find a college that's more in line with what we can afford. You don't need to go to Gonzaga. You don't have to go to Stanford. Not that you're smart enough to get into Stanford. Don't give me that look. You're not that smart, Johnny. Is that the name I gave him or Timmy? No, Johnny. Sorry, I forgot your name, son. You're not that smart. You're not going to Stanford or Harvard. We're going to send you to Bellevue College. We're going to send you to Seattle Community College, or whatever they're calling that one now. And there have been a lot of people who have been taken advantage of lately, folks who want to pretend that this kind of taxpayer relief or relief at the taxpayer expense is coming. You have the Elizabeth Warrens of the world, AOC, Bernie Sanders, and of course Joe Biden pretending that they're able to just dismiss a whole bunch of your student loan debt. You should not be counting on that, says Flanagan.
So there's clearly some impetus at the national level to try to find some solutions for long-term student debt, but it's not a good bet to just count on.
It's almost like she had another word or two to finish that sentence, but King 5 decided not to include it. Because King 5, like so many other local media, not even necessarily here, just not good at their jobs. But I digress. Let me refocus my anger and ire towards the college students. You're not a victim. I know that you want to be seen as a victim because you earn some social currency for that. You can go on your X account or your Facebook page or Instagram or TikTok, complain about your life, about how it's just not fair that you choose not to voluntarily pay back something you voluntarily took out to begin with and then promised under penalty that you would pay back. Because you get likes and retweets and whatever. I get the feeling that you feel, that you get when you're a victim. Like, I understand it. Other people are telling you that they care, that they see you as a victim and they're there for you. And sometimes you just need a hug. You're not getting that hug from me. First of all, I don't like to touch people. But number two, well, also you smell. So number three, because you're not deserving of that hug. Sorry. I paid back student loans. I took out some, I think it was like $32,000 in student loans. I went to a four-year college. At the time, I wasn't certain I was going to get into radio or television or writing. I was going to be a lawyer. And so it made sense for me to take on that level of debt with the intent to go into law school, knowing that what lawyers make, I'd be able to pay that back without straining too much. I end up going into radio. Radio does not pay well, certainly not when you're just starting out. I'm lucky now where I've gotten to a point where I've worked to a point to be a multi-billionaire doing Afternoon Drive on KTTH, getting a big book deal for What's Killing America. But the fact of the matter is, I don't come from some privileged background. If I can pay it back, so can you. And the difference was when I was paying it back, there wasn't this allure of being considered a victim. And now there is. Social media has made that worse. Pay back what you took out. That's on you. What have you been doing this entire time if not coming up with a plan? 1-800-465-8770 for your texts. It's the Jason Rant Show.